Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Jonathan Lowenhar. Jonathan is the founder and managing partner with Enjoy the Work. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, thank you. This is going to be fun.
Excellent. Likewise. Excited to have you on. Let's start with Enjoy the Work. What's the company's premise?
I like to refer to myself as the founders don't get fired guy. I had this moment a long time ago, a little bit more than a decade ago, where I read too many articles in short succession of founder CEOs being fired from their own companies, from terminated by their own companies. And so I started to kind of deeply explore what are the things that cause this? What are the set of circumstances that lead to such this terribly sad event, right? Founders pour their mind, soul, body into getting something from just an idea to something that matters in the market. Then they build something that is valuable enough that a board starts to care about their trajectory. Something goes sideways, and it could be the board's fault, it could be the founder's fault, it could be the market's fault, but something goes sideways. And the decision is made for that CEO to get fired. I hate that. I hate that more than anything else in startup life. And so I've built an organization designed to try and fix that.
Hmm. And so I'm curious, were there any founders in particular? I heard the articles. Of course, my thoughts come to Steve Jobs, but I'm going to ask, any particular stories that really resonated with you?
No. It was a list of them. It wasn't one. There's this odd paradox that seems to be true in startup land. And that is, the more success a founder has with a given startup, the more that business ascends and grows in revenue and valuation, that actually the less control that founder ends up having or the founders end up having of their own business. Because most startups that try and grow really quickly end up taking on a lot of capital. And ultimately, both the board and the overall cap table swing from being founder controlled to investor controlled. And I'm not saying by definition is that's a bad thing. But what is definitionally true is that the risk for the founder to be ousted from their own business actually rises the more success that founder has. And noticing that pattern, where what would seem to occur is the business is now worth something. The business now matters to the investors that are involved, who've all now made promises to their colleagues and indirectly to their LPs that this one could return the fund or this one could be material. That too often, most of those investors seem to only have one lever to pull when they're confused by the gap between the investor memo they once wrote and the actual performance on the ground. And that lever is, oh, let's replace the CEO. And I'm being callous and crude in this example, and there are times that the founder deserves it, and there are times that the board is right. But too often, that lever seemed to be getting pulled prematurely from the collection of stories, Christian, that I was collecting.
Yeah. And so you start Enjoy the Work. What's the approach that you take to start to align expectations and put founders at least in a position where they have a bit more control, even if it doesn't if it isn't represented on the cap table?
So I'll go back to the beginning, and I'll tell the non-marketing version of the story. I left my last startup at the end of 2014. That business did really well. I was the first non-founder president of a young fintech business that had like 200,000 in revenue and a couple of million in funding when I got there. Mm-hmm. And I was there through the first $20 million in revenue and about $100 million in capital. And then that business eventually got acquired by SAP for about $900 million.
Wow, congrats.
Thank you. I came out of that and I took a few months off to just get healthy. I lost 25 pounds and lost all sorts of levels of stress and traveled and got my life aligned and actually met my wife during that duration.
Awesome.
On the other side of that, I start meeting with founders again. Coffee dates and walks and what have you. And I meet this one particular founder who had a fintech company about 10 million in revenue, just barely profitable, sizable team. And we have a delightful first conversation. The chairman was a friend of mine. That's where the introduction came from. And I have a chat with the CEO, and he said, "Can we go have dinner? I want to do this again." So we meet for dinner. And at the end of dinner, he says, "I want you to join the company." And he makes this grand pitch because he's one of these impulsive, charismatic characters. And I told him, I said, "This is flattering and you're insane. We've known each other for a meal." And he pauses and laughs and he said, "Okay, how about this? Can we just chat once a week? You've already done what I'm trying to do. You've already walked this path." And that was interesting to me. Said, "Yes, we can talk once a week." 3 weeks later, I meet another one, Christian. A month later, I meet another one. Over the course of a number of months, I now had a list of CEOs who all wanted to do the same thing with me. And it came so easily that I knew it wasn't about me. There was some unmet need in the market. There was some problem in the market because it was too easy. By the way, 1 year later, I had 16 of these CEOs, and their companies didn't look anything like one another. Like this was fintech, and this was hardware, and this was healthcare. And the CEOs didn't look at like anything. This one was a five-time founder with exits, and this one was a first-timer who was 23. So what was the problem? So I started to interview investors. And I asked investors all three questions, the same three questions over and over again. Question number one, describe to me your ideal founder. I'd say, like, imagine you had a petri dish and you could just pour a bunch of shit in there. And what came out of the other side was your perfect founder. They would say, "Oh, okay, well, this is a person." Their answers were amazingly consistent across the planet. "This is a person who has tenacity and persistence and a unique insight." They all said effectively, "This is someone who sees something no one else sees and they won't give up." Great. Question number two. Describe to me your ideal startup CEO. Christian, they didn't use any of those that prior description. They would list skills. This person can build a financial plan. They can raise money. They can build product. They can sell things. They can recruit people. They can manage a board. So my third and final question, it's rather obvious with this lead up, was, okay, well, how does a founder learn those skills while doing the job? And I got blank stares. So this awakening for me was founders actually don't know how to become a CEO. We leave them to their own trials to figure it out. Or boards flip the one switch they know how to switch, and that is fire them. And the reason founders don't have these skills is not because of lack of desire or interest or discipline, what have you. It's because it's like the one job in the world that's incredibly high paying, for which we've never constructed a pedagogy or a curriculum. We just figure, founders, go figure it out. But the game is so different. Founding a company is about courage and character. Like, I'm going to just go take a shot at this. Running a company is about a set of skills. The job just changes the moment the thing you've birthed into the world starts to have some success. Your job goes from improvising and experimenting to find some sort of fit to building a version of a factory that can repeatedly deliver that thing to your audience. It's a completely different job. And we don't actually support the founder in that journey. We just hope they'll figure it out.
How many years into enjoy the work are you now?
10. We're
So,
throwing a big anniversary party in the fall, which will be very fun.
congratulations. Awesome milestone. So I'm curious, why do you think more board members or investors default to flipping the switch versus nurturing the founder and saying, hey, this is an option?
So, apologies for being reductive. I think venture board members are normally distributed. The large group of them are in the middle, and they're fine. They have little to no operating experience, and they provide value in four ways. They make introductions, they write checks, they provide some strategy help with big questions, like at 30,000 feet, and they provide governance. There is nothing in that that actually suggests they get into the weeds of the business to understand what's working and what's not. They only see output. They only really see kind of the lagging indicators of what's happening. And because they haven't sat in that seat, they don't know what to do. So their interpretation is, we've misforecast X number of times, or I don't agree with the direction of the business. Or, as I alluded to somewhat playfully earlier, the dream that had been articulated in the original investor memo seems to have fallen into the harsh face of reality. And now they have all of this confirmation bias that kicks in with limited real data. And so they pull the switch they have. Now, I say it's normally distributed because I think on the other two sides, a couple of standard deviations away from the middle, you have some investors who are extraordinary. They are former operators. They operate with high empathy. They actually create so much honesty and safety that the CEO says, here's what's really going on. Here's all the data. Here's my leadership team. I want you in the mix. You've seen this pattern more times than I have. Now, that board member is still not providing training. And I think this is a really key distinction I want to come back to in a minute. But at least that board member is honestly saying, our incentives aren't fully aligned. Yours are to common shareholders, mine are to preferred, mine are to my LPs and my partners. Yours are to yourself and to your customers. But they're aligned enough that we can go try and win together and let me see how I can help. And there is a slice of the venture capital board community that operates that way. And by the way, there's a slice on the other side that are predators. I would use that same distribution model, Christian, by the way, for founders themselves. There's a
Sure.
large population of competent folks in the middle. There are some amazing ones, and there are some unethical folks that everyone should avoid. I draw this distinction between those four value props that a normal board member can provide and training. And I'll draw the distinction with a story. I had a Series A founder of mine in the ad tech space. This is a number of years ago. And the company was working. It was founder-driven sales at the time. It was sub 20 employees, but month on month and quarter on quarter growth was interesting. It was a mid-market play, and he was able to turn and turn and turn. It was working. Gross margins were attractive, and there was enough repeatability to the sales motion that we thought we could hand it to someone else. And so, coming out of a board meeting, the board decides it's time for our first VP of sales. And the board is kind of all, and I'm being a little bit hyperbolic here, self-congratulatory and pat themselves on the back. And they walk out of the meeting, feel really good about themselves. Decision's been made. That CEO calls us immediately and says, how do I do that? Because the difference between the strategy discussion of it's time for a sales leader and the execution on the ground is the Grand Canyon. And the vast majority of investor board members can't bridge that gap in any way. So we interview the board, we interviewed the CEO and figured out the profile. We walk the CEO through, here's what sourcing could look like, retain search, hybrid search. We do the search ourselves. We just do network. We then built an interview plan for how would we vet these folks that come through. Then we built a ramp plan. We built a commission structure all with him so that we actually could connect all the dots between let's hire a VP of sales and we have our human. And by the way, 5 months later, she started and she was great and she worked with us for 4 years there.
So, notwithstanding the impact that Enjoy the Work is having working with founders, is there any part of you feel that the pendulum swings between, I don't know, ignorance is the right word, but just a lack of understanding that, execution is a step to today where maybe there's a better appreciation that hey, founder burnout's a real thing. Maybe we should ask why and take steps to better support them.
I think there have been a few paradigm shifts, sounds too strong, but there's been more momentum on a few different fronts that feel very different ever since lockdown, like ever since pandemic onset, like March 2020. One is that was the first time an entire generation of founders heard, you might not raise more capital. You better go learn this crazy idea of how to have more cash coming to your business each month than go out. I imagine you were on the receiving end of a few of those phone calls of, we now need a financial model that doesn't work backwards from the next fundraise, but actually works backwards from profitability.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Giant shift.
Yeah.
I do think giant shift number two is, I think about if I remember admitting to a grandparent of mine in 2005 that I was seeing a therapist for the first time. I was 32. And my grandparents' reaction was, let's say, not positive. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why are you so weak? And it was, the questions were from a place of love, but incredulity, like could not believe that I would waste time, money on such a charlatan, such a fake profession.
Yeah.
I think that is largely gone from startup life, and that there are therapists everywhere amongst the my founder community. There are coaches everywhere. And I think, by the way, they are normally distributed like the same group I described earlier. And there are some that are amazing and there are a lot that are fine. There are some that are awful. And I think those two big shifts of, I now need to run a healthier business. And in order to do that, I have to be healthier. I don't think either of those things were true a decade ago or as true.
Sure. I mean, that makes really good sense. As I was listening to you mention your grandparents, my thoughts went there. Just having, I mean, my parents had me later, so my grandparents were older, and it just generationally, they look through things with a different lens.
Yeah.
So I infer net positive. I want to come back a bunch more questions and enjoy the work, but before I do, you gave us a little bit of background on your success as an operator, congratulations, and leading up to how you founded this. But can you give us take us maybe back to the beginning? Give us a sense of what the progression looked like and how it informed how you see the world today.
It was an utterly smooth path up and to the right, like every financial model I've ever seen. As you and I chatted offline a bit, Christian, I grew up Jersey, parents New Yorkers, and my family had been in and around casino gambling in a variety of ways for several generations. And so I grew up New Jersey with my father who was working in Atlantic City, and I wanted to work in casinos. So I went to hotel school for undergraduate Cornell. I interned at three different casinos during my undergraduate years, and I moved to Las Vegas the moment I finished. And so career number one for me was working in those large, shiny buildings in Nevada for about a dozen years in like sales roles, marketing, operations roles, et cetera, until eventually my last two roles, I ran a billion-dollar business segment for a large public company and then became a private equity CEO for a privately held casino hotel company with three casinos and four hotels and golf courses and restaurants and, lions and tigers and bears. And I loved it. I loved it. I didn't want to live in Nevada anymore, but professionally I was deeply happy. I then had this odd, unique opportunity with one of my prior companies that paid for me to go to graduate school. And I did this program that was a joint program between Columbia back in New York and Berkeley, and I fell in love with the Bay Area. I moved to the Bay Area then full time, part time in 2004 and full time in 2007, and spent about a year kind of in the professional desert. No one would hire me. I was a strange casino guy. So I kept applying for jobs, and I would hear the same things late in my interview process. your skills are really interesting and very likely transferable, but I have this other candidate who's already done this job before. So to bridge careers, I made a choice. I had been dating a lot of companies. I playfully referred to it as my professionally promiscuous period. And one of the companies that I was spending time with was a two-person startup that had an analytics idea in the hospitality space. And they asked if first I'd be a board member, which sounded all sorts of lofty at the time. They had $180,000 of seed capital. It was just the two of them and a prototype that didn't quite work. But it introduced me to these two folks that were disciplined and hungry, and there was a lot about the idea that made sense to me. So I ended up joining as co-founder CEO, and this was fall of 2008, with the point of view being they're aimed at hospitality and it's an analytics play. I know enough here to be dangerous, and if this company ends up working at all, I will have bridged my career. And the company worked. So we ended up raising a couple of rounds of venture, sold the company in 2012. Christian, I made no money, but I had sold a venture-backed startup. And in this weird world of the Bay Area, it was a badge of honor. And when I left that business, I was flooded with interesting opportunities. And I ended up joining a very young fintech business that I described earlier in this chat, that ended up doing very, very well. And coming out of that company, when I reflected on my career at this point in my life, I was fortunate enough to have some money in the bank. I was healthy. And I had had this really varied operating experience from public company to private equity to multiple startups. And one thing that really dawned on me as I started to meet founder after founder is that well-run companies always look the same. They always have kind of the same ingredients, the same components. Like there's vision and mission. There's values that kind of describe how we want to show up. There are goals we work backwards from. There's a set of leading and lagging indicators that help to manage and course correct the business on a short time horizon. There's some communication infrastructure for how we're going to meet and how we're going to talk and how we're going to actually capture knowledge and institutionalize it across the team. There are just these building blocks for how good companies are run. And founder after founder of mine was unfamiliar with all of that. And so there was this light that went off that there is this giant difference between starting a company and running one. And the reason founders were getting fired is because no one was investing in the latter. And venture investors don't bother investing in it. They just don't bother because they make their money off the next wager, not the career development of a CEO. It's not that they're opposed to it, they just don't care. And the person who does care is the CEO. And so this movement of these programs that are out there, Enjoy the Work being only one of the companies in the space of how do we get founders to learn the skills so they choose when they want to leave instead of being chosen for them, that ended up being the last chapter of my career.
And so said another way, your experience resulted in a pattern recognition that enabled you to formulate a blueprint, and the blueprint, effectively says, okay, here's where I'm expecting to see these milestones or patterns. I don't, here's an opportunity for us to unpack why and see what needs to take place in order to get you back on the straight and narrow.
Yes, and as I said, smooth line up and to the right. It all makes sense now in reflection. Or because I was raised to play poker by the time I was 4 years old, and pattern recognition's pretty good for me. It has felt as I have reflected on my career that each of these building blocks now makes sense historically for myself. But from casino life to running startups to a service business around it, the connective tissue you have to squint at to see.
Interesting. I have just in a quick, a brief side note, only because we were talking beforehand. I did high school in New Jersey. We used to go to the Sands for $5 blackjack tables. What was your go-to?
That's outstanding. So my father worked at resorts, which is a different way of saying I went everywhere but there.
Got
However,
it.
yes, there was some of that. I do have very distinct memories of working at the Tropicana for a summer as a combination of front desk and valet, where I had to wear a pink jacket and a gold tie. At least this was before cell phones and smartphones were omnipresent, but did have friends who would show up with small Polaroids just to be able to capture that for posterity's sake. I enjoyed gambling back then. It was, I went through, this was, I'm not going to date myself. It was quite a while ago. I did go through five fake IDs one particular summer when I lived in Atlantic City before I was allowed to legally gamble.
Yeah, we liked the Sands because we found that they didn't card us and it was $5 tables, so it worked
Both
out.
are winners.
Yes. Good stuff. So, okay, so coming back to enjoy the work. Do you find that su your success in working with founders also includes their board members and investors as much as it does the founders, or is your focus really on the founders?
The latter, the focus is on the founders. Now, for that relation, for that person to have as much success as they desire, having a productive relationship with their board members is crucial. If there's any dysfunction among the leadership team, if there's any dysfunction between the CEO and the board, that is expensive beyond measure and often is existential, whether for the CEO or the company or both. And so, what we encourage is this language, Christian, of just one story. Please, God, operate with one story. And so, at any given time, we think that a startup is working backwards from one of three things, very simply. I'm either working backwards from M&A, I'm working backwards from profitability, I'm working backwards from the next fundraise. You got to choose one. What's the most important thing? What's the top of the mountain? And I want to make sure whatever that choice is now aligns with the board. Like, you both are choosing this. Great. So we're working backwards from a fundraise for the sake of example. Now we have to have alignment around what would have to be true to unlock that fundraise. Now, there's some art and science there, depending on the nature of the business, but there are a set of milestones or a set of metrics that reasonable people can agree that if these four things or seven things or two things are true about this startup, we're likely to find a market clearing price for us for our seed or our A or our B or our C, what have you. And then what needs to happen from there is all the domain of the CEO. What is the set of work required to unlock those metrics to get to that milestone? But if those first two pieces aren't, we're not in lockstep between board and CEO, or worse, the CEO is too young or immature or insecure, or the board doesn't create enough safety such that two stories emerge, the one that gets told to the board, the one that actually the CEO is operating with. That's like having a secret when you're in a personal relationship with someone. It's going to come out, it's going to be bad. So while we don't report to the board and we don't have fiduciary and we're not in any way able to formally hold the CEO accountable, if we see the two stories emerging, we will say to the founder, you need to fix this. And here are your ways to fix it. And if we actually think the founder is being going so far as to being unethical, we'll just leave the business.
Really exciting stuff you're doing, and I really resonate with this idea of working backwards. We take a similar approach when we put our fractional CFO hats on and work on founders. We ask them, "Hey, what's our destination?" And I have a lot of bad analogies, but one of the ones I like to use is, I don't know if you remember the old McDonald's Happy Meals, and they'd have the mazes. I would go to
Yeah.
the endpoint and I'd work it backwards.
Yes.
I'd say, hey, I figured it out. But, I mean, it's the same premise. It's a lot easier to chart an accurate course by working backwards. So I love it. Any founders or success stories in particular that you find was just a great success story when it was all said and done after you ended up working with them?
We've had, We've had the great pleasure now of working with more than 200 startups over the course of the decade. So I can say with a lot of gratitude, we've had a lot of them. I'll share one that was just in the news this week because they just acquired another business. And when your startups get big enough to start acquiring other companies, it's usually a sign of something good. I had the great pleasure of working with the team at Tipalti, Tipalti, that for those that are deep in fintech would know this company. They are a giant that started in the space of accounts payable automation and have expanded considerably since then. And with their recent acquisition, now are moving into treasury. I like telling that story. We got involved with that business when they were single digit millions of revenue, a valuation that was somewhere in the 125 million range. Their last public valuation was over $8 billion. It's now a sizable international business with offices around the world. But the reason I like telling this particular story so much is for early founders, the CEO of the business, he was running another company and he's talking to a customer, and the customer starts complaining about a problem he's having about being able to move money cross-border to pay vendors and the frequency with which those wires would fail. And they'd have to be redone. And the complexity and difficulty of staying regulatory compliant and dealing with FX changes and making sure you are in compliance with different tax regimes as you cross borders, all of that was just driving the customer crazy. And it was all painfully manual, handled by a team of financial operations people. This is a world, Christian, you probably know better than I do, even. So the CEO, Chen, basically says, if I build this thing, what will you do? The guy's like, I'll be your first customer. So this isn't a story of the CEO Chen goes out and then goes raises $5 million and builds a team. Like, no, he writes the code himself. He builds product one himself. He deploys it himself for 2 years and gets it all right, certainly right enough for customer number one. I am an enormous believer in founder-driven sales at the beginning, especially for anything that's B2B. I'm an enormous believer in making sure that you have this point of view of a problem in the world, that you validate that the problem's real, that the problem's worth pursuing, that you can solve the problem, even with some janky first version of the solution that has smoke coming out of the sides, before you start to move to anything repeatable. And he did all of those things. And so people look at that business today and see a business that is doing an enormous amount of revenue with a huge amount of capital in the bank. And they can now wield that capital as a strategy to buy others with an international footprint where they are, by definition, the winner in their space. And they don't see the fact that for the first 2 years of this business, this was just one guy writing code, even though this was like his fourth company already and he was in his 50s already at the time. That's the story I like to tell.
That's great. I love it. Yeah, I mean, all the points you touch on, are recurring themes within the podcast. I think your assessment's spot on. And it's great to hear real world, and congrats to them. I mean, I think are many founders who are aiming for the big leagues, and to see brethren do it, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Jonathan, before we wrap up, I love asking a retrospective question. And if you had a chance, go back, share some insights and wisdom with your younger self. What would you say?
I do play this game quite a bit with myself, especially in therapy sessions. A few things. One is there is no joy to be found in comparison. I actually think one of your recent guests mentioned something similar. If that person has better shoes, or that person has a better job, or that person has a better physique, it's a game that can't be won. The idea of finding your own joy, your own satisfaction, your own happiness in who you are, number one. Number two, a phrase I learned much later in life, but one that I started to apply 20 or 25 years ago before I had the phrase, and that is, discipline is the gift you give yourself. It's the gift for tomorrow. And all the little things that I used to do each day have paid enormous dividends now as I'm older, whether it's in my mental, spiritual, physical health, the quality of my relationships, the quality of my work. And so the daily discipline, which feels easy to say no to in the moment because the rewards are so far off in the future, I would tell my younger self, you can't imagine. You can't imagine how it can pay off.
I think both of those are great insights. Yeah, it's challenging. We live in a world of duality where we can only know something if we compare it, but it's a trap at the same time. I mean, I guess it depends on how you use it to inspire you, but I agree. It could be such a big distraction, if not wielded the correct way.
Yes, it was for me.
And I think it's also great. I mean, pay now, pay later.
Right.
But I, for our younger audience members, I know my theory is it's the by virtue of age, you have less experience than when you do you're older. So you have to take our word for it that things change and you're in this great spot when you're in your 20s. Take advantage of it. And so, I think spot on. Jonathan, anyone in your network you'd like to give a shout out to who's had a material impact on your life and your career?
I'm going to go, since we're only 2 weeks removed from Father's Day, I'm going to go with Dad.
Awesome.
My father was an academic early in his career. He was a economics professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. He then started a consulting shop on the side. That consulting shop started to get more and more work in Atlantic City with the advent of legalized gambling in the late 70s. And my father loved it. And he got more and more work there until he started to get very senior executive roles offered to him, such that he left academia. He did the unthinkable and left tenure, while at the same time was playing in bigger and bigger neighborhood poker games, such that he earned enough money just from poker to pay for my undergraduate degree. When I look around the Bay Area, we think about startups and we think about the person who's vibe coding at 3 in the morning at home with five monitors set up. But my father was an entrepreneur multiple times over. And he left academia to start his own consulting firm. And then he left casino gaming in the 90s and started his own firm again. And it created a beautiful life for himself of freedom and the kind of economic prosperity to take care of his family. He just operated in a way that was really this odd match, this unusual match of discipline and improvisation that has fed me really well.
That's awesome. Well, kudos to Dad. And having examples like that, just creativity is amazing. It's a beautiful expression, and to be able to witness it from someone who brought us into this world, I think is a big deal. So that's awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Jonathan, before we wrap up, if there are any members of our audience who want to learn more about Enjoy the Work or just want to get in touch with you, how can they find you?
Yeah, there's always these two paths that a founder is dealing with. One is what does the company have to get better at to like get to their seed round, get to their Series A, what have you? And then what skills did they personally have to get better at? And for the founder who's interested in both, improving the company and improving themselves, come to our website. There's a contact form, enjoythework.com. There's a contact form that we are obsessively responsive to. And always happy to have a first chat.
Fantastic. Great stuff. Again, Jonathan, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. And for the benefit of our audience, again, Jonathan Lowenhar, founder and managing partner with Enjoy the Work. This has been another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrack Management. Thank you for joining us. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.